discussion over the safety of farmed salmon and the risks posed by fish farms are prescient ones worldwide and more so here in British Columbia. If Quebecers are defined by their language, conceivably British Columbians are defined by the Pacific salmon, so argues a new book from Harbor Publishing, A Stain Upon the Sea. It is an important overview of the fish farming industry as well as a strident and robust case against it. Otto Langer joins me on the line now. He is a former Federal Department of Fisheries and Oceans biologist and is the director of the Marine Conservation Program for the David Suzuki Foundation. Mr. Langer is considered one of Canada's leading authorities on the issue of open net cage salmon farming and is one of the DFO's most outspoken critics. He is a contributor to A Stain Upon the Sea. Welcome to the commentary.ca, Otto Langer. Good afternoon, Mr. Langer.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us. First of all, the book has a preface by David Suzuki and an introduction by Terry Glavin. We'll get into the other contributors in a sec here, but in the introduction that Mr. Glavin writes that aquaculture is a very old method of raising marine life, I guess, and it's been used throughout history, and he gives examples when it's been used throughout history. As an industry, however, worldwide as well as in British Columbia, it has grown quite fast and quite quickly. Why is that? Is that just because people want to eat salmon, or is that the government's encouragement? Is that the industry's wanting to exploit the resource?
Well, I guess we're at a good 6 billion plus people on the globe, and we overfish our oceans. There simply isn't enough fish to feed everyone. And what makes the problem even worse is that we've mismanaged most of our world fisheries. And so the fish that we were able to produce 20 years ago, we're not producing half that amount anymore. And chances are the fisheries are going to continue to go downhill. So that's quite important. And people do appreciate that fish are a healthy food. So more and more people probably are trying to eat fish. So in a sense, it's probably not a good time for people to more and more demand fish when wild stocks are going down. So obviously the business community has seen a great opportunity here, and let's grow more farm fish. And I agree with Terry Glavin. We've been growing fish for thousands of years, but there was a big difference. I'd say past production was sustainable. We were feeding vegetable matter to fish like carp and mosquito fish, whereas nowadays we're getting into salmon, and salmon are carnivores. So what we're doing is we have to feed it meat, and for every pound of salmon we produce, so we might feed it 2 or 3 pounds of other fish, and from an ecological point of view, that doesn't make much sense.
And those other fish are anchovies, herrings, mackerel, right?
Yeah, from the oceans of the world, whether it be Iceland or off Chile, fish meal comes from many countries in the world, and we don't produce a lot in Canada, so we do import fish meal from other parts of the world, including from Chile.
Is there a devastating impact from where we get those particular fish that we feed our salmon?
Oh, in the past, if you look at the fishery in Argentina, those waters have been largely overfished. And in the past, we used to even have what we called rendering fisheries on this coast back in the 1960s and the early 70s, where we used to catch thousands of ton per herring and rendered them down into oil and fish meal, and that devastated our herring fishery. So the meal or the rendering fishery was banned on the British Columbia coast, so you can see that these fisheries, if not controlled and not managed in a sustainable manner, can have great impacts on wild stocks.
Now, I'm not a biologist, and I don't really eat fish that much, so you'll have to excuse, you're going to get a lot of inane questions from me. I look at this as a political issue as well as a consumer issue, so that's how I read this book. The argument that aquaculture feeds the less fortunate, the poor, the hungry, I guess that doesn't wash because salmon is, the farm salmon even, is expensive and the market is for the affluent, is it not?
Yeah, I would say it's basically, I'd say the opposite. Salmon definitely are not feeding the poor people of the world. How many people in Africa or even the aboriginals of South America are eating salmon as a source of protein? Very few. In fact, you could argue in Chile, they're losing their native stocks of fish to their meal fishery. So we can then import that meal to Canada or to Norway and grow salmon for the rich people of mainly Japan, Europe, and North America.
that's farmed on the west coast of Canada here on the west coast of British Columbia. Is that not the Pacific salmon?
Yeah, but there's five or six species of Pacific salmon. If you include steelhead, what we used to call the steelhead trout, if you call that a salmon, which it is, we have about six major main species. And the steelhead has been farmed, the coho has been farmed, and the Chinook salmon has been farmed. Probably the Chinook is probably the best of the West Coast species, but they don't farm anywhere near as well as what I call the domesticated Atlantic salmon from Europe and Eastern Canada.
And so that's what's predominantly being farmed, is it not?
Yes, and that the pressure was put on government in the 1980s, and the federal government and the BC government agreed that Atlantic salmon could be introduced into British Columbia. So when that happened, most of the industry did switch over to Atlantic salmon. They grow quicker, and they're not as wild, and basically they're almost a domesticated animal. It's almost like a domesticated pig swimming around in their cages.
Now, who are these farmers? The essay that was in the book before yours is by Rosella Leslie and Betty Keller, and they gave an overview of the industry. And these are not mom-and-pop operations as they were once in the past. These
yeah, 20 years ago they were mom-and-pop operations, and now they're pretty well multinational corporations, and five or six major companies control most of the fish production in the world and in Canada.
Is the line between the companies that farm salmon, is there a clear line between them, from them to the government in terms of, like, do they support the government or do they support the political parties, for example? Or?
Well, I haven't done a search of campaign contributions and that, but when we did see certain problems on this coast with one of our ministers, one of his largest contributors was one of our local fish farming companies. And that minister did have authority to relate to the fish farms and their governance. So, the industry knows who to support, and they'd be quite disappointed if they didn't get some return for supporting certain candidates. I mean, that's an unfortunate part of the democratic process.
And so the governments have been complicit in all of this, and
well, I'd say more so due to higher-level government agendas such as jobs, 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 and wealth, wealth, wealth. And I think that's, you could say, though, that's just not an understanding of the value of what the natural ecosystem gives us, in a sense, for nothing. All we have to do is protect it and manage it. And when you allow a natural system to produce fish in the North Pacific Ocean, that doesn't create jobs, and people don't get rich. But if you start creating fish farms, you create a lot of jobs to build the nets, build the floats, build the boats, hatcheries to raise the young fish and make the fish food. You can employ fishermen in other countries producing the fish food. So in a sense, you can see a large number of jobs being produced quite quickly. And from a government agenda, even though we, in theory, would like to think governments think of sustainability nowadays, but I would say it's sustainability of the economy, and it's definitely not sustainability of the environment. And if we don't bring those two concepts together, our children are going to be in real trouble in the world, not just Canada.
Now, the Alexandra Morton talks about this in her essay, and she discusses the Brown Archipelago, which is, pardon my geography, that's the, I guess, the northern part of Vancouver Island, is it not?
Well, it's probably the area east of northern Vancouver Island. It's that archipelago is a collection of islands, so it's a collection of islands between North Vancouver Island and the mainland.
Okay, and so she discusses in this, and I believe you do as well, that 3.6 million spawners pass through that area.
These are wild fish, yeah.
Wild fish, and they've in one single generation, they've gone down to 147,000.
That's correct. That happened a couple of years ago, yeah.
What caused that?
Well, there was a lot of controversy, and we hired some ex-DFO scientists to do a study, and Alex probably was the first person to ring the alarm bell on that issue when some local people actually saw pink salmon, in a sense, belly up floating in the ocean, and they were covered with sea lice, and they were dying, and that was the first indication that there was a problem. And when you look at the billions of eggs being produced by the fish farms, and this is a migratory pathway for the wild salmon, it was very unwise for the government to allow that, because we had 10 years previous history in Europe that sea lice. These are little copepod parasites that attach to the wild fish as well as domestic fish. When you get a louse load of three or four or more on a little salmon, it'll kill that salmon. And so I'm quite convinced there's a direct link between fish farms, Atlantic salmon, the production of excessive amounts of sea lice, and those sea lice are being released from these farms into the wild waters where they will attach and attack young salmon and kill them. So there's no doubt that that's happening. However, one can't say that's the only thing that was harming some of those runs that caused that catastrophic collapse. But a very good DFO scientist did a coast-wide survey right from California to Alaska, and he says, never in the history of pink salmon have we seen such a catastrophic collapse, and the epicenter of that collapse is right where the fish farms occurred in the Broughton. And DFO now are backing off from that, and they're trying to pretend there's no proof that the fish farms are creating all these sea lice that are harming the wild runs. But I think the circumstantial evidence is excellent, really. And a lot of things in our society we'd have moved, such as the link between tobacco and lung cancer. Well, obviously, we haven't proven a really, really strong link there, but the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming, and society acknowledges that. And sea lice, most scientists from Europe and that appreciate that sea lice are a problem, and they'll devastate wild runs, whereas in British Columbia, the provincial government and the federal government, in the name of DFO, is totally living in denial.
Now, that's because of the open pens, is it not? If they were in closed pens or on land, we would not, I assume, not have these problems, right?
We could have the problems, but they'd be greatly diminished, and that's one of the positions many of us, including the Coastal Alliance for Agriculture Reform on the West Coast, have taken, is that the first step is to ban open net cages. They're having a significant environmental impact, and it's more than just sea lice. It can be transmission of bacterial and viral diseases. It can be the organic waste coming out of the cages and smothering the bottom life in the ocean. It can create a number of problems, and the best way to get around that is have a closed containment system where you can collect the waste. And however, if you return a lot of the water being from a closed system back into the ocean, you could still affect wild fish. So they have to treat that water like any other waste, or recycle it, or do whatever is necessary. And that innovation has to take place as soon as possible.
And governments in the industry are I guess, in denial and saying that nothing's going on. And they're, of course, not supportive of closed containment. Is it? Do they cite cost as one of their excuses? Or?
Oh yeah, it's really the lack of technological development. But I think a number of companies could come up with the technology if someone was willing to subsidize the development work. Plus, yeah, it's presently the cost, and this is the cheapest way to produce fish, and they're doing it in Norway. They're doing it in Chile. Why would we do any differently? Because we have to compete against them.
We're talking with Otto Langer. He's a contributor to a new book called The Stain Upon the Sea, $26.95 Canadian from Harbor Publishing. Let's bridge into the political aspect of all of this. You once worked for the DFO, and you talk about, and this is the title of your essay, that any fish is a good fish. Would you explain that?
Well, I came up with, coined that expression when I was with Department of Fisheries many years ago, and it would annoy a lot of my peers in Department of Fisheries notions, but when it comes to hatchery production or to sea farms, I think it's a very appropriate comment that it appears as though any time you're producing fish in British Columbia or maybe in Canada, the Department of Fisheries notions would look upon that as a saintly thing to do, and those enterprises would be exempted from environmental impact reviews, pollution permits, that type of thing. And I always said, well, as long as you're making a fish, it's a good fish. And they just would never acknowledge the genetic impacts you could have on wild runs, some of the disease and real problems that we're seeing from fish farms. And that's quite unfortunate. And by that agency taking that view, basically, they've given fish farming almost immunity from the Federal Fisheries Act, despite the fact that we've had hundreds of violations of the Fisheries Act on this coast. Not a single fish farmer has been charged under the Federal Fisheries Act for whether it be pollution, destruction of beaches, the release of what I would call a harmful alteration of habitat, the release of Atlantic salmon into our waters. It just goes on, and basically Department of Fisheries has confused their mandate to conserve wild fish with their non-legal mandate, which is a political mandate to promote fish farming in Canada.
The BC Liberals, in their recent convention, I guess there was a resolution on the floor saying that they should speed up the process whereby licenses for fish farms would be, the process would be speeding up so that if you wanted a license, you could get it quickly. I guess the provincial government as well is complicit in this as well, are they not?
I'd say almost more so. They've very definitely been promoters, but you could argue they don't have a Fisheries Act that says, gives them direction from Parliament to protect and conserve wild fish in Canada. So you can almost pardon the province. They've laid off so many of their scientists and biologists over the years, and they don't have a good legal mandate that's a federal mandate. You can almost excuse them and say, they're really just into business promotion, and any dollar's a good dollar. So I almost accept that from the province. I think that's unfortunate. I think our children's children are going to resent that when we build a giant ecological deficit in British Columbia. But, they're complicit in this. There's no doubt about it, but I would probably even be harsher of the federal government. They have a clear mandate, and they're simply not doing their job.
When you raise these concerns with both the federal and provincial governments, what do they say? Do they just ignore you, or do they just deny that anything's wrong? Or?
Oh, yeah, you can play that game, and they're almost like the cigarette companies. There's no proof. Atlantic salmon aren't doing any damage in the coast. Even if they escape, they won't survive. Even if they survive, they won't get in our rivers. If they get in our rivers, they won't spawn. And they'll just come up with all of these excuses. And that's why I say they're totally living in denial. And basically, they'll go overboard to defend the industry because that's what their political masters want. Canada, some 15 years ago, said, the federal government said, we're going to promote fish farming in Canada. And there's no new legislation giving them the authority to do so, and then that responsibility was dumped on Department of Fisheries and Oceans in 1995, and DFO has made that a higher priority than enforcing their protection of the environment or protection of fish and fish habitat, which is a constitutional and a legal mandate. So you can see politics are extremely important, and if you're a civil servant, you can ignore your legislation and what the House of Commons wants you to do, but you can't ignore what your minister wants you to do.
So is the, for consumers and for people in the grassroots, for people like us, what can we do? Is that to vote a certain way, or is that to lobby?
I think you've got to, well, first of all, I'd say every time you go to our restaurant, whether you even want to eat salmon that day or not, I've been making this a practice the last several years, I'd say, the salmon on your menu, is it wild or is it farmed? And more restaurants have switched over to wild salmon, and I think that's a good thing to do. And secondly, I think all of us have to start raising a bit of fuss. We can't live, our children's children can't live in this world if we destroy important parts of the ecosystem and destroy certain species, and we seem to be perpetuating that lost species on Earth, and we're even doing that in Canada, and we should be a much more enlightened democratic leader in terms of protecting our environment and the ecosystem we live in. We've got to fit into that ecosystem, so I think everyone's got to be more aware of that, and they've got to hold Paul Martin and Jeff Regan, the fisheries minister, responsible. And we seem to have government after government. We seem to have sometimes enlightened fisheries ministers like David Anderson. And David Anderson just totally ignored the fish farm problem, even though he did get concerned about the survival of coho and other fish species and provide a good leadership to protect those species. But no one is willing to take on the fish farm industry because that seemed to be a national political important agenda to promote. And so I think we've got to get after the politicians, really. Of all places in the world, we have ourselves in Alaska and into Siberia, we have the last runs of wild salmon in the world. The Atlantic salmon's been destroyed all over Europe, all over eastern North America. And why would we put fish farms, salmon farms, into the part of the world where we have the last healthy wild salmon runs in the world? It just doesn't make any sense. So I think the public have to show a bit more outrage, and to some degree I think the public has been desensitized. They hear so many environmental disaster stories every day that I think a lot of people are turning off, and that's truly unfortunate.
Yeah, and I do recommend this book because it is at once informative as well as another frightening. You write, and I found this interesting, that there are 30 DFO directors in this part of the country, and you say that they do not have the necessary knowledge of the area and of the problems. Where do you find enlightened leadership, and where do you find people to fill in those spaces in the civil service where there are knowledge gaps?
Yeah. Well, I think the principle of merit has to apply, and I think nowadays we have hiring practices that are more important to have, and I support gender equity and this type of things, but it's more important at times than merit. Or your ability to speak two languages, two official languages, and one language, and now you can't be a director in British Columbia if you're not fluent in French. And so right away you've ruled out a large number of experts on this coast of getting higher positions unless they are willing to go back east for several months to try and become fluent in French. And we had an excellent biologist on this coast for many years. He was sent to Ottawa several years ago, and a year ago he was appointed the regional director general of this region, and he's failed his French exam three times, and he hasn't been allowed to take up his post on this coast. So we've just had acting director generals on this coast. And when you start doing business like that, fish become a number four priority. Bilingualism is more important. Gender parity is more important. And what's even more important is you've got to suck up to Ottawa and be friends of the important people in Ottawa, and then you'll become a director someday. Merit really doesn't mean that much anymore, and at times you can have directors running the show that really don't know one end of the fish from another, and after all, this is still a fisheries business.
Time is running out, I suppose, in terms of I mean, the damage has already been seen, so do you have hope that there'll be change, that there'll be...
Well, I'd say the first sign of hope is if the governments would get their act together, as they finally have done in Norway. They're not allowing fish farms in certain river systems in their far north, yet we seem to be gung-ho, and as you pointed out, the provincial Liberals are going to try and expedite the approval process so we can get more and more fish farms up the north coast. And we're just ignoring the problems they've created in the central coast, such as in the Broughton Archipelago. And, we're going to do more and more damage to our wild fish runs. And it's really hard for a lot of us to sit back and write letters and get after Safeway and get after other stores for not selling these salmon. And governments are basically ignoring the signs in the environment, the signs that wild salmon are being stressed by this additional pressure on them. And at times, I think people are feeling a bit demoralized.
Otto Langer, good luck with this book, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks very much for having me on.
It is a prescient book, and it does make a robust and strident argument, and as I said, its importance can't be overstated. A Stain Upon the Sea by Stephen Hume, Alexandra Morton, Betty C. Keller, Rosella M. Leslie, Otto Langer, and Don Staniford, with a preface by David Suzuki and an introduction by Terry Glavin, $26.95 Canadian from Harbor Publishing. Tomorrow, Sheila Copps will be on with her book, and Monday we'll talk to Peter C. Newman. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plana.